There is a moment when the sun disappears, when darkness falls, and you're left with just your fears. That's the moment you feel your first pang of doubt. That's the moment when the night comes out.
Episode 1, Vermilion. The history of the world, in nearly every culture, there are blood-sucking creatures of all kinds. Blood is life, and the idea of this life being drained is, and always has been, terrifying. Vampires, in all their forms, are scary. Vampires live in dirt and drink blood, and they are the walking dead. They should smell of death and decay and blood, and strike terror in the hearts of those that see them. There is little that is truly romantic about them. In the tiny, dying town of Vermilion, Illinois, something is coming. Something that has been coming for a long, long time. Something primal and ready to wreak vengeance upon what population that's left. One stormy night, Vermilion will receive death when the storms come. When the night comes out. It has been said that the town of Vermilion, Illinois, is cursed. If you were to see what it has become, you might be willing to agree, but the story is rather interesting, even if its truthfulness is in question. Like so many things that happen around these parts, it goes back to a story about Native Americans. The tale goes that the town of Vermilion was on the fast track to becoming one of the biggest cities in the state. That much is fact, though, as there was even a time when the city became the capital of the state of Illinois. Sitting right on the Mississippi River, Vermilion was a transportation hub for steamboats, and there was a thriving community. In that community was a wealthy man who ran most of the town. He had a daughter, and that daughter was willful and wouldn't listen. And she fell in love with a Native American fellow back at a time when Native Americans were called Indians and not respected much by other people. Needless to say, the father did not take too kindly to this, and he forbade his daughter to see this boy again. Of course, like most of these tales go, she didn't listen and she snuck out, and it was only a matter of time before the father caught them. He then paid to have men come and find the young Native American boy. And do you think he turned him over to the police or just ushered the kid out of town? No, he did not. The father had the young man beaten, and then he was tied to a large log. The young man lay there bleeding, arms outstretched like a religious symbol, and the father pushed the log off into the rushing waters of the mighty Miss. This is where the curse comes in. Reportedly, the Native American boy cursed the town of Vermilion. He said that the river would eventually reclaim the town, wiping it from the face of the map. Whether or not there ever was a Native American boy or not, who knows? But there certainly seems to be an air of doom around the place. I mean, can you blame it? Vermilion was a thriving city, but there came a flood one day and most of the town was washed away. When the Mississippi River receded a bit, it didn't recede the rest of the way. Now there were branches of the river rushing past both sides of the city of Vermilion, essentially turning the city into an island in the middle of rushing river water. We are now a tiny town with rushing water on all sides, technically part of the state of Illinois, but with the only bridge into the place being across to Missouri. So go figure. The town has flooded several times since then. The Ole Miss is one mighty bitch when she wants to be. The last time I remember it being completely flooded was back in 93, and the entire town was covered in something like 9 feet of water. Those of us that were left, just about 30 people at that time, were evacuated. We all came back, and many of us said we would stay here until the island was gone, but most of the young families moved away. These days, there are just 15 of us left, most of us descended from those founding families from long ago. There are a couple of young folks, but most of us are older, like me. Heck, I'm one of the younger of the older folks, being only in my 50s, and the rest of the town looks like something out of a museum. There's the downtown area with a small store and a restaurant that barely does any business. There's a few houses and there's even a park, complete with playground equipment, even though there are no kids to play on them anymore. There's also a small city hall, a library, and a church at the far end. It's a pretty town with lots of trees and green grass, but it is also very quiet, with many, many empty houses where there were once families, and the rushing sound of the river never quite goes away when you're outside. People live in fear each spring when the rains come, and wonder if this will be the time when the curse finally hits for the last time and washes the last bit of this town away. I awoke in the absolute darkness of midnight, the night that the stranger came. The weather people had been predicting a bad storm all day. The year before, we had had a drought in the area, and people joked that maybe Vermilion was going to become part of Missouri and join the rest of civilization again. Then came that hard winter, with lots of bad snowstorms, one after another and another, and buried the town in snow. Then came the rains that spring. We all gathered in the diner, and Myrtle and Fred cooked some delicious hamburgers and fries. The rest of us all gathered around and talked about the weather. We talked about whether or not it was time to evacuate again. "It's just a lot of nonsense," said Derek Brixen, the man who currently served as mayor. "They always say it's going to be worse than it really is." "Yeah," said Alice Smithers, clutching her husband Wally's hand. "But we're due. It's been a long time since 1993. "I say we stick it out," I said. "I think we'll have time to get across the bridge and get out of here if the rains are bad." Everyone else sat there for a moment. Outside, the sun was shining down and the sky was blue and it looked gorgeous. But the people who had spent most of their lives living in Vermilion, like me, knew that just over the horizon, a storm could be brewing. We all ate the burgers and talked back and forth, but like most of the meetings we had as a community, it didn't amount to much. It was just easier to go back home and watch the news and the Weather Channel with growing anxiety and worry than it was to actually start packing and moving. So the Weather Channel won out. When I went to bed, it was raining, but it was hardly the deluge. I even opened the window in my bedroom a bit because I liked the sound of the rain when I slept. It was soothing, not pounding and driving the way the sound of the river was. I fell asleep and was dozing when the first booms of thunder came. I awoke suddenly, my eyes wide, staring around the room. It sounded like a trillion tiny ants, all of them wearing armor, were stomping around the roof and the walls of my house. As I watched the wall in darkness, lightning lit up the room, and I saw everything in my bedroom like a photo negative. This was followed by a booming crash of thunder that seemed to shake the earth. "Damn," I muttered. I got up and out of bed and got dressed quickly. When I made it to the living room, I saw that the streets were already flooding. The rain was coming down in sheets. I hadn't seen rain like it even back in 1993. I felt a stab of worry pierce my gut, and I put on my raincoat and headed out into the rain. I got into my truck, started it, turned on the headlights, and pulled out. Even with the wipers going full steam, it was nearly impossible to keep up with the rain. Each flash of lightning forking across the sky lit up the darkness. Vermilion was not a town filled with streetlights, so it got dark at night. Each stab of lightning pierced to the back of your eyeballs. By the time I got to Fred and Myrtle's, it looked like everyone else had beat me there. That figured. I was notorious for being a heavy sleeper. I could see that they were worried. Amy and Clyde, one of the younger couples, had apparently already packed up their belongings because their SUV was filled to overflowing with things. The other cars were also probably packed to overflowing. Everyone looked worried. I walked out in the pouring rain, which felt like it wanted to pound down anything that moved like a fist, and ran into the diner. The bell over the door sounded, just as another blast of thunder rocked the ground and the building around us. I shook off my raincoat and hung it up on a rack near the door. I tried on a smile. "Well, who wants to call me wrong first?" I said as I made my way to the booth. I got a few laughs out of that, but most everyone was grim. "We were just discussing who was going to go up there and wake up Martin," Derek said. "We were just about to head over to the bridge and get out of here. The Weather Service has officially issued a flood warning for this area, and it looks like the rain ain't gonna stop for about 24 hours. We need to get out of here while we can." I nodded and then sighed. "Yeah, I guess you're right, Derek. We'd better all head for the bridge before it's gone and we have to call in the National Guard." Everyone sat quietly for a moment. I wished that Myrtle had some coffee brewing or maybe some of her great breakfast cooking. I loved her hash browns, and that was not a euphemism. However, Fred and Myrtle had apparently locked up and were ready to go. As for me, I had a sister over in Missouri who would probably be expecting me, and I had moved stuff over there years ago just in case these things happened. I kept thinking I might just move out of this place and move to the land again, but it was hard to leave the place where you grew up. After a moment, we all got up and headed for our cars. The rain was still coming down like a waterfall, and Derek took the lead. I was somewhere in the middle, behind Amy and Clyde. The rain was even harder than it had been earlier, and it was so hard to see more than a few feet in front of the cars. I was worried that the river might already be rushing across the bridge. We were headed towards the bridge, just out of the downtown area, when the sky to the west erupted in light. It was brighter than the lightning itself, and the flash extended up over the trees and the houses. A second later, the ground beneath us shook so hard that all of us slammed on the brakes. Derek got out of his car first. I was next. Then Wally Smithers came, and Clyde followed. We all made our way towards the front of the line. Derek was peering ahead into the rain like he could see anything. Derek took his job way more seriously than anyone else who was mayor of a town of 15 people should have. "What was that?" Clyde asked. "Was that lightning hitting something?" asked Wally. Derek shook his head. "No, that wasn't lightning," he said. "That was louder and brighter than lightning and thunder." "Then what was it?" I asked, now with a jagged knife of fear in my gut. "I think something blew up," Derek said, looking back at us and squinting as the water ran into his eyes. "What?" Fred exclaimed. "What the hell are you talking about, Derek?" "I'm telling you that I have seen dynamite used before, and that was sure a lot like dynamite," Derek said. We all stood there getting soaked for a bit, staring at each other. The rain was highlighted by the headlights of our cars. "So what blew up?" Amy said. All of us turned around in surprise. None of us had heard her walk up.
"I don't know," Derek said.
"But there isn't much up that way besides the bridge." All of us stared wide-eyed now.
"Who would blow up the bridge?" I asked.
"Derek, you're full of shit,"
Wally said, suddenly turning around and heading back towards his car.
"I'm going."
"Wait a minute, Wally," Derek yelled. Just then, another boom of thunder hit. Wally did not wait. He got into his car and drove around us. I felt the water splashing the lower part of my legs as the car flew past. I watched him go and wondered if I should head back home and hope that this rain stopped, or drive after him.
"Well, let's go,"
Derek said, and he headed back towards his car.
With that, it was decided. I got back into my truck and I turned up the heat. I was soaked to the bone and I was shivering. I had a feeling that the shivering was not because of the weather. We made our way up to the bridge. When we got there, driving in a single-file line, Wally's car was there, parked off to the side. It took me a moment to realize that Wally was standing there staring off into what was the Mississippi River. It took me another moment to realize that he was staring off into the darkness where the bridge should have been. It was nearly pitch black, and that should have been the first warning because the bridge was the one place normally lit up like Times Square, since we never wanted anyone coming home at night and driving off into the river because it was dark. I parked my truck and got out, and I was beside Wally in seconds. I heard other doors opening and closing, and feet sloshing through puddles. Our headlights shone out, and it was obvious now that the bridge was gone. The river itself was angry and rushing past, but it was still below the flood stage. In other words, the bridge had not gone out because of the river. "Who would do this?" Wally asked, and he looked at me. I saw fear in his eyes. "I have no idea," I said. "Was everyone at the diner?" Derek asked. "Was anyone missing?" "What are you implying?" I asked. "Jesus, Derek, you know everyone in this town. Do you think that suddenly one of our community was a terrorist sleeper cell all this time? And what, they got the call to blow up a bridge in some town in Illinois that no one has ever heard about? For what purpose?" Derek turned on me, the headlights making his eyes blaze. "Well, look at it, Martin. The bridge was blown the hell up. Someone had to do it. The bridge did not decide to commit suicide." "Both of you shut up," said Fred, who stood there in the downpour with his arm around Myrtle. "You know this means that someone has either come into this town and did this, or someone on the other side did this to keep us here. We've got to get back to town now and call in the National Guard." We all looked down at our shoes. I studied the puddle that was growing at my feet. I sighed. This had happened before when I was much younger, and the guard had sent helicopters and guys in boats to rescue people from their rooftops. Suddenly, the earth shook again. It was so sudden and so loud that I opened my mouth and screamed. All of us turned and looked back the way we had come. A huge column of flame and smoke shot up into the air. This was followed by another brilliant flash of light and another shock in the ground. We all felt the shockwave moments later. It was like getting hit in the chest with an invisible baseball bat.
"Jesus!"
Derek yelled.
"Back in town!"
Wally yelled, always stating the obvious.
"What the fuck is going on?"
Amy screamed. I began to run. I didn't want to stand around and stare at these people any longer. I bolted for the truck and got in. I saw that the others were running as well. Just as I got the car turned back around, the horizon lit up again and there was more smoke. I could see that, despite the rain, there were fires burning ahead. They wouldn't last long, but they were burning intensely right now, and smoke was billowing. We all drove far too recklessly back into town. The entire downtown area was ablaze. I pulled my truck off the road at the small park just west of the town square. The diner was blazing. The church was devastated. The white steeple that was a hallmark of the town was gone. The city hall blazed away. Debris was scattered in the street. The street itself looked as if it had buckled from the shockwaves. I stepped out into the rain again. Just like at the bridge, I heard the other car screeching to a halt behind me. I felt fear. I felt true fear close around my heart and stab me in the gut. The town blazed and smoke filled the air. The rain still pounded down, but there was apparently enough dry still inside those buildings to keep burning. Maybe a gas line had burst. Whatever it was, the sky was lit with flames, and smoke filled the streets, obscuring much of the area.
"What is this?"
Derek yelled. He stood in the street with his hands by his side and his legs spread.
Who did this?
Wally was carrying the gun that he kept inside the glove compartment of his car and also stood in the middle of the road. We formed a kind of loose circle in the middle of the main downtown intersection. The city square and the park stood behind us, and it felt very open and vulnerable.
What do we do, Derek?
Wally asked.
Jesus Christ, what the fuck do we do?
What's that? I asked, pointing into the smoke that was pouring out of the ruins of the diner.
That's what's left of my goddamn diner!
Fred said, and the pain in his voice was agonizing.
No, in the smoke,
I said, pointing more emphatically. I wasn't sure if I was seeing anything for real. With the rain and the smoke and the darkness, I thought my eyes were playing tricks on me. Then, the shape in the smoke became more solid. It was a shadow, the absolute absence of light, moving through the smoke. In fact, it was as if the figure was forming from the smoke itself, like he was the smoke, or the smoke and fire were part of him. He came down the middle of Main Street like he owned the road, like he had no fear. He was huge, a hulk of a man who, as he walked, seemed to absorb the light. The smoke parted in his wake, and he walked towards us. As he came closer, his features, his clothes, gradually came into focus. He wore a long black coat, like a duster. It hung across his massive shoulders and down to his ankles. It moved like something alive around his legs. He wore a large, wide-brimmed hat across his eyes and across his face. His boots clacked heavily against the pavement. He wore black gloves on his hands, and his hands looked like a gunslinger's. Hung at his side, fingers spread like they were ready to grab guns hung low on his hips. Across his chest and hanging at his side was a large bag of some sort, and I immediately knew that this was the bag that had contained the dynamite he had used to blow the bridge and the town.
Hold it,
Wally said, raising his pistol.
Hold it right there, you son of a bitch! I will shoot!
The man stopped. I felt rooted to the spot, as if my legs could not possibly move even if I commanded them to. I had never felt such fear. I looked to my left and saw that Derek was as wide-eyed and terrified as me. No one moved. The stranger had his head down for a moment, and he might as well have been a statue. Then he slowly raised his head. The light from the fires and our headlights caught his face, and I gasped. His face was smooth and pale. He appeared very young, but gave off a feeling of a creature that was older, perhaps, than time itself. He looked at us with eyes that were beyond dark. They were like black holes, absorbing the light around us while simultaneously piercing us with cold. And he looked from one to the other, taking each of us in, marking us. His lips were almost purple, like a corpse. I could also see tufts of white hair poking out from beneath his black hat. I got the feeling of a gunslinger again. When he was done looking at all of us, he smiled, and even whiter teeth peered at us. He set his bag down at his feet and looked at us again. "Then shoot," he said. His voice was not deep or loud, but you felt it in your bones. Wally fired. He did not hesitate. He was not a great shot, but he was close enough to empty the pistol into the man's gut. Even when the six shots were done, Wally kept pulling the trigger. The stranger did not even move. It was as if the bullets vanished into the dark folds of his coat. When Wally was done, he raised his head and looked at the man. I saw Wally's knees go weak, and he nearly fell. If it had not been so wet already, I would have bet that Wally wet himself when the stair crossed over him.
It is Judgment Day, the stranger said. His voice was not angry or filled with emotion. It was a statement, like saying that it was raining. Judgment Day for Vermilion. And just like that, the stranger moved. One moment he was there talking, and the next he was in front of Wally. He was a blur that your eye just did not register. In a flash, the blade he had tucked into his coat was out, and he had slashed Wally's throat all in a matter of half a second. Wally made a gurgling sound, and then he started to falter. The stranger caught him, and then pulled the spouting neck to his lips. As I watched in growing horror, the stranger began to drink the spurting fluid that jetted from Wally's neck. Despite the rain, I could distinctly hear the sound of the blood that dribbled down his chin and spattered onto the pavement. The gore flooded into the man's mouth, and Wally got paler and paler, finally collapsing into the man's arms, his eyes rolled back into his head. It seemed to take forever. No one said anything, no one ran. Where would we run? I have no idea why I didn't even move. I just didn't. We just stood there and watched as this creature drank Wally dry and then threw his empty corpse aside and then turned its dark eyes towards the rest of us. Derek tried to run first. He managed to turn and make three steps towards his car before the creature was upon him. There was a soft tearing sound, like a harsh whisper, and a blade was slashed across Derek's throat. Derek staggered away, his hands clutching at his jetting artery. Again, the stranger buried his face in the spray of blood, opening his mouth to catch as much of it as he could. The others tried to run, but they never stood a chance. He got Fred just as Fred reached his car, his hands clutching the air and reaching for Myrtle, who sat in the car staring as the stranger ripped Fred's head clean off his body and drank the blood that spewed forth. Myrtle was next, and the man punched his hand straight through the window and ripped her windpipe out with his bare hands. Amy and Clyde were running hand in hand down the street when the stranger descended upon them. His blade severed their hands and then slashed left and then right. More blood jetted into the rain, and the stranger drank what he could before moving on. He moved like a blur, from person to person, slashing, cutting, tearing. And I stood there in the middle of the intersection, unable to move. Each of my friends, people I had known for years, were torn apart in front of me, and I could not run. I could not scream. I saw judgment, and it came for me last. Each of the descendants of those who had created this town. He held a head in his right hand as he walked towards me. I knew that I should at least try to run, but it was pointless. I just watched as he walked up the road in the rain, the duster moving gracefully around his legs. As he got closer, I could smell him. I smelled the fresh blood, but there was something else there, older, more ancient than anything man had made. The blood of 1,000,000 years came off of him. Beneath that was the smell of earth, the dirt of millennia. Beyond that was decay, like rotting flesh. He towered over me, blocking my view of everything in front of me, save for the long black duster and the wide-brimmed hat. His old young face stared at me with nothing resembling hatred or anger. This was what he did. I knew it then. This was what he had always done, for centuries. Whatever had made him what he was, this was now his task. He brought down judgment, and judgment had come to Vermilion. His eyes that almost appeared as sockets rather than irises and eyeballs, regarded me. He cocked his head from one side to the other. "Do you not fear me?" he asked. I nodded. "Yes, but would it do me any good to run?" He laughed. Again, the laugh was not evil, not terrifying,
but almost pleasant.
No.
Why now? I asked. This town was cursed so long ago. Why now?
He seemed to think about that for a moment. Then he shrugged.
It just is. For some things, there are no answers.
I nodded.
I guess not. I felt like I should ask more. Here was a timeless being, the stuff of nightmares, the vampire out of the horror movies, and who had probably seen things that I couldn't imagine. Yet I found I had no questions to ask. He had nothing else to say. He moved in closer, and I stared into his dark eyes. My legs still would not move. Judgment had come to Vermilion, and it would drink its blood. Then the waters would come and wash all of us and what remained of the town away. Who was I to try and deny that? I barely saw the blade. The poor residents of Vermilion never knew what hit them, but they knew they owed a debt paid in blood. You've been listening to When the Night Comes Out, a horror anthology podcast with stories by Brian W. Alaspa and narrated by Allie James. For Brian's work, visit his website at www.brianwalaspa.com or visit amazon.com for his books of fiction and nonfiction. Be sure to listen to Allie's work on Facebook at Allie James Projects.